While we have a few comments to make before we get back into the flow of the class, first of all, I've had a ton of comments back, and I really appreciate that. That's been wonderful. I was telling you last night, I write this weekly thought for the week, and the great thing about writing that is the feedback that you get and the conversations you get into it, so that's a real blessing. So thanks for all the comments. I'm going to share a couple of them with you. First of all, I just want to remind everybody, as we talk about fasting, I'm not saying you've got to do this, okay? Just want to remind you, you don't have to do this. If you don't want to do it, Kyle didn't say you had to, okay? So I just want you to think about it and just realize the detail that's in Scripture about it. That's it. You know, going back to this idea of getting started with this thing, you know, and I had suggested, you know, maybe a 24-hour fast. I just want to emphasize, in case, you know, this is lost, a 24-hour fast means missing two meals. Okay? If you think this is like some sort of extreme wacko thing or something, I'm talking about, you know, if you have dinner, go to bed, wake up, and you skip breakfast and lunch and have dinner again, you have fasted 24 hours. So it's when you think about it, you know, a lot of people just are so busy, they skip breakfast and lunch just because they don't have time to eat. So I just want to say, you know, what I'm saying is not, you don't have to fast 40 days, at least not the first week. The most I've ever done is 3 days. Okay? Fourth thing I want to say, we have a nutritionist here, and if she wants to out herself, she can. And she said that when she was licensed to do this and stuff, the doctor she was working with said that a 3 to 7 day fast was perfect for detoxing your body. And the emphasis on it cleanses your body of all these impurities that we build up by the foods that we eat and stuff. So just to throw that out again, it's, you know, and what we're emphasizing here again this week is detoxifying our spirit. Detoxifying, you know, if you make it an exercise in spiritual cleansing, that's the emphasis we want to place this week. Yeah, it's great that your body gets detoxified and stuff, but what we're really talking about is the detoxification of the spirit through prayer, through meditation, through focusing on some aspect of your life or the life of other believers. Second to last thing I wanted to say is, how many people in here know what Facebook is? Okay, a handful. To get you up to speed on Facebook is it's sort of a social networking thing on the internet. Basically, what you do is you sign up, it's free, and you pick your friends. You say, oh, you know, I want Jennifer Daniel to be my friend, and I send her a note, and she says, yeah, I'll be your friend, and sends it back and says, okay, so we're friends now. Well, the nice thing about Facebook is if she does something, she posts something on her little Facebook and says, oh, we went on vacation, here are the pictures. You know, we don't talk all that much, but it'll be sent to me, and I can go and look at her pictures. And so it allows you to keep track of your friends without having to, you know, be on the phone all the time or emailing one another. It's a really neat kind of thing. All of my friends on my Facebook are Christadelphians, and it just allows me to keep track of brothers and sisters and friends and young people, and it's really cool. So, anyway, there's a second aspect to it. The reason I'm bringing this up is an aspect of Facebook is you can have groups that have common interests. So my thing was, I'm going to throw this out and I'll wait for feedback from it, is if you'd like me to start a group for fasting, biblical fasting, and would like to join that group and share your experiences with that as we start exploring with this, if you would find that helpful, you would find that useful, I would do that. I'll be glad to that. I'll be your friend. You can be my friend. And then we can just use this as a way to communicate with one another about that experience, you know, and learn from one another and glean from one another. So just throwing that out there for people. The last thing I wanted to say before we jump back into the class is I want to talk about the books that I have read, and I'll leave them up here on this little silver stand behind me. And like I said, if you want to take one and take it home with you and read it, and most of these, I think all of these have my address in them, just send it back when you're finished. So they are, this was the one that started all this with me. Sister Dana Pratt handed me this book, and she goes, I think you ought to read this. I think you'd like it. So I read it, and I liked it. It's called God Chosen Fast by Arthur Wallace, and it's, as you can see, it's old and falling apart and everything, and it's got stains in it. But she gave me this book, and so you're welcome to read that. And this focuses on less on the physical aspects and more on the spiritual aspects of fasting. This is called The Sacred Art of Fasting, Preparing to Practice by Thomas Ryan, and he's a CSP. I don't know what that means. But it's, anyway, you can look at that. Here's a little one, a real small little book, The Miracle Results of Fasting, Discover the Amazing Benefits in Your Spirit, Soul, and Body, by Dave Williams. It's from the Christian Living series. This one is Fasting and Eating for Health, A Medical Doctor's Program for Conquering Disease by Joel Furman, MD. This one obviously focuses more on the medical aspects of it, if that's your interest. This one is called The Miracle of Fasting, Proven Throughout History for Mental, Physical, Mental, and Spiritual Rejuvenation, by Patricia Bragg, Ph.D., and Paul Bragg, Ph.D. And then probably the most appropriate one for me is The Complete Idiot's Guide to Fasting. And this talks about the spiritual aspects of it, but it's all different, you know, Buddhism and Islam and whatever. But it also talks about the physical aspects of fasting. So anyway, they're all up here. You don't even need to tell me you're taking it. Just take it. And my address is in there. When you're finished with it, just mail it back. Okay. So we finished up yesterday talking about, or we were just about to start talking about unsuccessful fasting. And the one occasion where someone seems to be doing it with the right spirit that doesn't get the result that they're hoping for is David. And so I think it, you know, begs the question, why was this unsuccessful? And this is a fascinating chapter. Unfortunately, we don't have time to look at it, but there's a lot of really cool things in 2 Samuel 12. But why was this unsuccessful for David? And what he was fasting for particularly was that God would spare his child with Bathsheba. And God, as we know the story, God did not spare the child. But what I would point out, though, is that David did get a really, really amazing gift. What did he get? He got his life. He got forgiveness for a sin, two sins, that under the law of Moses would have brought death. So I put unsuccessful in quotes because I don't know if you can really say that it was unsuccessful. That he did get an amazing blessing from this in the forgiveness that he received, even though if he didn't get the saving of his child. What I would also point out to you is interesting. We talked about fasting as a sign of mourning. When David's child died. You remember what the servants were saying about, you know, they didn't want to tell him. Why didn't they want to tell him? Yeah. They were afraid he was going to harm himself. They were afraid he would be so distraught. And so they didn't want to tell him. But David notices them sort of whispering to themselves and said, "Is the child dead?" And they said, "Yes." And what does David do? He gets up and he washes and he eats, which is the exact opposite of what they would have expected, which tells you something about David's motivation here. It tells you something about, gives us more insight into fasting and the mindset of someone fasting. David was not fasting for mourning in the sense of mourning the death of his child, because the child hadn't died. He was humbling himself before his God, and he was praying in fervent prayer, hoping for a miracle that God would spare this child, of whom God said he was going to take this child's life. And once the death of the child occurred, he got up, and it was not for mourning that he was fasting. It was out of humility and penitence and hope that God would spare this child's life. So anyway, just an insight there. Right. He did not show any disagreement with God's judgment. He accepted that. It was God's will. It was done. And he was going to move forward now. I'm not sure that was entirely unsuccessful. I think that was absolutely required in the circumstances that David humble himself before his God. Now, another one I put in as unsuccessful. I said there was only one, but this one I put a caveat on what I considered unsuccessful fasting. And unsuccessful to me means that it's being done in the right spirit, but doesn't get the result that is hoped for. And this one, this is Saul and Jonathan with the Philistines. And so we'll read this passage. It's 1 Samuel 14. 28-31. Then answered one of the people and said, "Thy father straitly charged the people with an oath, saying, Cursed be the man that eateth any food this day. And the people were faint. Then said Jonathan, My father hath troubled the land. See, I pray you, how mine eyes have been enlightened, because I tasted a little of this honey. How much more, if haply the people had eaten freely today of the spoil of their enemies which they have found? For had there not been now a much greater slaughter among the Philistines. And they smote the Philistines that day from Michmash to Ajalon, and the people were very faint." I go back to that Ecclesiastes quote. You know, there's a time and a place for everything. We read in the New Testament that before Paul and Barnabas went on their missionary journey, they fasted. Other than the ship, they fasted on or at least the Gentile sailors on the ship fasted when they were in the middle of the Euroclodon, the storm. There's no indication he was fasting, because what was he doing? He was walking miles every day and preaching and burning up a lot of energy. And so it seems to me that probably it's not a good idea to fast before during a major battle, where hand-to-hand combat is involved. And it was unwise on Saul's part to demand that of his men. This was a time when you eat and not a time when you fast. And there's times in our lives when we should be eating, and there's times in our lives, I think, that we should be fasting. This was obviously one of those times when where the wrong decision was made. And I think this is very enlightening for us, in that there are times when we shouldn't be fasting. There's times when there's work to be done and needs to be done, and that should be our focus. Okay, let's go to fasting miscellany for 500, Alex. There are four instances in the Bible of fasting for 40 days. Moses did it twice, at both givings of the Ten Commandments. And Elijah did it once when he was fleeing from Jezebel and went down to Mount Sinai. And of course, Jesus did it in the wilderness. Now, there's a lot of connections, and I'm going to leave you guys to make the connections between a lot of these things. But it's fascinating to me. So Moses fasted twice at Mount Sinai and Elijah at Mount Horeb. And Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai are what? The same mountain. Okay? Begs the question to me, we're not told where the wilderness was, where Jesus fasted. Did he go to Mount Sinai? Or did, you know, as maybe others have suggested, did he go to Mount Nebo, the Mount of Transfiguration, or where did he go? But maybe he went to Jesus went to Mount Sinai. This is sort of my spin on where God tests Moses, but God comes to Moses and he says, you know, I'm going to wipe out this whole nation. I'm going to make you start a nation over with you. And I believe that was not... I believe that was a test for Moses. I believe that Moses was being tested there, because you know his response to Moses, Moses' response to God is, well, you know, don't forget about Abraham, and don't forget about Egypt and what's going to happen to those people. I mean, you know, they brought you out, and then you're going to destroy them in the wilderness. Don't forget that. And it's like, well, God didn't forget that. You know, one like God said, oh yeah, right, Abraham. Oh, I've changed my mind now after you reminded me about Abraham. I think this was about Moses, you know. And so I think God was testing Moses then. And so he was given the option to be the only one. You can be the only one, Moses. You can be the start of the new nation. Elijah thinks he's the only one when he comes down there. And, of course, Jesus was the one when he was tested in the wilderness. In the instances, in both instances, we have this theophany experience where both Elijah and Moses see God, and they see the characteristics of God. Was there a theophany experience there? What's interesting in these things is there's, all these things involve thunder, Moses and Elijah involve thunder and lightning and fire and a trumpet-like voice, and in Elijah's, it's an earthquake and wind and fire and a still small voice. And in Jesus' case, you've got three temptations and the Word of God answering those temptations. You know, maybe a stretch, but anyway, all of these people appear at the Transfiguration. So there's another connection between Moses and Elijah and Jesus, and again, the only three that went through a 40-day fast. It says, Mark 9, 2-4 says, and after 6 days, Jesus taketh with him Peter and James and John and leadeth them up into a high mountain apart by themselves, and he was transfigured before them, and his raiment became shining, exceeding white as snow, so as no fuller on earth can white them. And there appeared unto them Elias or Elijah with Moses, and they were talking with Jesus. And this is an amazing, interesting chapter of which we are not going to spend any time on. But I would just challenge you to go and look at these comparisons and contrast between these events. For example, you know, who goes with them on each one of these fasts? And it says specifically in those chapters who did or who did not go with them. And it seems like a throwaway fact until you start comparing these things to each other. But I'm going to leave that up for you, because this is not a class on Transfiguration or primarily on those four events. Okay. We talked about the Day of Atonement is the only day where God said you must fast, and again you can make an argument that He also said that on Purim, but we're not going to make that argument right now. So let's just look at Leviticus 16, 29-31. And this, it says, this is to be a lasting ordinance for you. On the 10th day of the 7th month, you shall deny yourselves. And do not any work, whether native-born or an alien living among you, because on this day atonement will be made for you to cleanse you. Then, before the Lord, you will be clean from all your sins. It is a Sabbath day of rest, and you must deny yourself. It is a lasting ordinance. And so the NIV says, deny yourself. And the King James says, afflict your soul. But this is referring to fasting. And it is, we understand that it's afflicting one's soul from that. That's what's being referred to from by comparing with Psalm 69, verse 10, and Acts 27, 9. So the use of the phrase afflict one's soul means it refers to the purpose of fasting again. That in this one, it's a spiritual intent of this. It's not the physical intent. God wasn't telling the Israelites, you know, you need to drop a few pounds or whatever. There was a spiritual intent to this, and it was on this day when forgiveness of sins was brought to the fore in the minds of the children of Israel. And so again, one of the focus areas I think that we can focus on when we fast is on a particular area of our discipleship that is lacking, or where we are deficient, where we are sinful, where we are succumbing to the flesh. And we can focus on that and pray about that, meditate upon that, and use fasting as a tool to perhaps get an answer and get a relief to that burden. All right. This chapter is the fasting chapter, and it's Isaiah 58. And the whole intent of this chapter is talking about fasting. So I will read this chapter to you. Give me a second to turn it up if you're inclined. Isaiah 58 says, cry aloud and spare not. Lift up the voice like a trumpet, and show my people their transgression and the house of Jacob their sin. Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways as a nation that did righteousness and forsook not the ordinance of their God. They ask of me the ordinances of justice. They take delight in approaching to God. Wherefore have we fasted, say they, and thou seest not? Wherefore have we afflicted our soul, and thou takest no knowledge? Behold, in the day of your fast ye find pleasure, in the exact of all your labors. Behold, ye fast for strife and debate, and to smite with the fist of wickedness. Ye shall not fast as you do this day, to make your voice to be heard on high. Is it such a fast that I have chosen, a day for man to afflict his soul? Is it to bow down his head as a bulrush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Wilt thou call this fast an acceptable day to the Lord? Is not this the fast that I have chosen, to loose the bands of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, and to let the oppressed go free, that ye may break every yoke? Is it not to deal thy bread to the hungry, and that thou bring the poor that are cast out of thy house? When thou seest the naked, that thou coverest him, and that thou hide not thyself from thine own flesh, then shall thy light break forth as the morning and shine, and thine health shall spring forth speedily, and thy righteousness shall go before thee. The glory of the Lord shall be thy reward. Then shalt thou call, and the Lord shall answer. Thou shalt cry, and he shall say, here I am. If thou take away from the midst of thee the yoke, the putting forth of the finger and speaking vanity, and if thou draw out thy soul to the hungry and satisfy the afflicted soul, then shall the light rise in obscurity, and the darkness be as noonday. And the Lord shall guide thee continually, and satisfy thy soul in drought, and make fat thy bones, And thou shalt be like a watered garden, and like a spring of water, whose waters fail not. And they shall be of thee, and they that shall be of thee shall build the old waste places. And thou shalt not raise up the foundations of many generations, and thou shalt be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of the paths to dwell in. And thou shalt turn thy foot from the Sabbath and from doing thy pleasure on my holy day, and cause the Sabbath a delight, the holy of the Lord honorable, and shall honor him, not doing thine own ways, nor finding thine own pleasure, nor speaking thine own words. Then shalt thou delight thyself in the Lord, and I will cause thee to ride up upon high places of the earth, and feed thee with the heritage of Jacob thy father, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken it. That's Isaiah 58. As you probably gather by that chapter, again says fasting is not the ends that we are seeking. It's a means to an end. And if we go about this the wrong way, without the right spirit, if we're doing this as some sort of rote way to justify ourselves in the eyes of God, or to declare our own righteousness or whatever, we are missing the point. And this is the same with everything. We could turn up Isaiah chapter 1 and we could read about the Sabbaths, and we could read about the new moons, and we could read about the sacrifices. It's the same thing. God says all those things are an abomination to me because you're not doing this in the right spirit. And I would tell you, and I mean this, you know, 100% sincerely, if no one leaves this class and goes and fasts, but gets the right spirit in their hearts from Isaiah chapter 58, this would be time well spent. Because that's what it's all about. That's the essence. And, you know, you know that we fool ourselves. You know, we've all have this Diabolos mind in us, and we lie to ourselves, and we try to, you know, figure out ways to take the easy path and to, you know, diminish God's word where He says this, and we say, well, you know, like I did on, you know, love your enemies. Well, He didn't really mean love your enemies. He just means, you know, it's like hyperbole, right? You don't hate them. And we fool ourselves. And we fool ourselves into thinking that there's some other way to do this other than really sincerely and humbly bowing to the will of God. And there's not. There's no magic bullet, and fasting isn't it. But neither is breaking of bread, and neither are prayers. Because God said the same thing about prayers to the children of Israel. He said, your prayers are an abomination to me, and I'm not going to listen to them anymore. Does that make sense? Any questions or comments about Isaiah 58? Because it's a whole chapter about it. I'm not going to spend but a few minutes on it.
Ray
said the last verse talks about feasting on the inheritance of the Lord. And look, God has provided us with so much bounty. And He's promised even more. It kind of goes back to David, you know, in that same chapter we were looking at, where David was fasting. God says this very interesting thing to David. He said, look, I've given you all this stuff. I've given you your master's wives and da-da-da-da, and I would have given you more. That wasn't good enough for you, David. You had to go take this other man's wife. And you know, God is our bounty, and He provides for our every need. Oh, you know, are we a glass half full, a glass half empty, or a glass overflowing person? You know, do we feel that we are overflowing in God and Christ? Do we feel like our cup runneth over? Or do we feel like, you know, we're maybe a third full or something? I think God has blessed us so much with so much bounty, and I mean spiritually. It's just there for the taking. just there for the taking. And so if you feel empty, you know, fight for it. Fight for this gift that God is allowing His Son to die to give you. He wants you to have it so badly. Did you have any other comments about that, Ray? Yeah. Did you hear the comment? He said, Jesus said, I have meat that you know not of. Jesus was feasting all the time. Even when he was sitting there talking with the woman in the well and hadn't eaten for a long time, he says, look, I've got meat that you know not of. I'm feasting on the Word of God. I'm feasting on the blessing that God has given to me. And you, the apostles, you don't know of it yet. They were still arguing about who was the greatest. And we're missing the point. Any other comments about Isaiah 58? Questions? All right, we're going to segue into a new topic, and that is the connection between fasting and famine. Fasting or famine is an act of discipline or self-discipline. And you'll see this very quickly, I think. That's a really spiritual concept. If you discipline yourself, you won't need to be disciplined. But if you don't discipline yourself, you need to be disciplined. Not that you're not going to get any discipline if you are, you know, self-disciplining yourself, as we can only read the book of Job to prove. But, you know, It is a tool for discipline, and God uses famine as a tool for discipline. Exodus 16:3 said, and the children of Israel said unto them, would to God we had died by the hand of the Lord. In the land of Egypt we sat by the flesh pots, and when we did eat bread to the full. For ye have brought us forth into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger. You know, just a sidelight, if you're like me, which hopefully you're not, but if you're like me, you've sometimes read the story of the children of Israel as they're wandering through the wilderness, and you're saying, what is wrong with these people? You know, they've just come through the Red Sea. They've seen the fire, the pillar of fire that protected them from the Egyptian armies. They've seen the 10 plagues. I mean, what's wrong with these people? You know what they were grumbling about? They were hungry and they were thirsty. That's pretty basic needs. You know, what do we complain about? What do I complain about? Too much traffic as I sit here in my, you know, $25,000 car with the air conditioning on and the radio. This guy pulled out in front of me. I didn't get that promotion I deserved. Or, you know, these people were complaining about being hungry and thirsty. So before we're so quick to throw the stones at those people for complaining about lack of basic necessities, I think we need to look at kind of how cush we've got it. But God, in His wisdom, was making it hard on them in the wilderness. And I believe this was His way of giving them self-discipline and helping to discipline them. He wasn't doing this to be mean. He wasn't doing this out of spite. I think He was doing this to help them. And there's some other evidence of this. We read this before. And He humbled thee and suffered thee the hunger and fed thee with manna, which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that He might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. So, famine, it seems to me, is the reverse, if you will, of fasting. And it seems cruel, perhaps, until we realize that, you know, I talk about fasting as scratching and clawing our way to God. And I think famine is God's way of fasting and clawing His way to us. He's trying to touch us on such a deep level the basic necessity for food that he's desperately trying to get us to recognize our need for him. And it's a horrible thing, famine. But I think that it as Romans says, it works for good. Did you have a question?
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Right. And that's an excellent point. And the you know, is Christ sufficient for us? That's the, you know, when we bring this forward to us, is Christ sufficient for us? You know, the Apostle Paul said he learned a secret, the secret of being content in whatever state he was in. You know, what was that secret that Paul knew? What was the sufficiency of Christ? You know, then whatever place he was in, that was where he needed to be. That's where God had put him, and he could rejoice in that. And you know, it's a very hard lesson to learn. Again, because our diabolos is telling us, well, this is not good. This is bad. You know, this is not, God's messed up here. This is a mistake. I shouldn't be here. Things should be different, you know. My wife or husband should love me more. My kids should have straighter teeth, you know. Whatever. And we tell ourselves these lies. No? Not that way, Clive? Right. Yeah. Yeah. Very much so. Thank you for that. Genesis 41:29-32 says, "There will come 7 years of great plenty throughout all the land of Egypt, and after them there will arise 7 years of famine, and all the plenty of the will be forgotten in the land of Egypt." The famine will consume the land, and the plenty will be unknown in the land by reason of the famine which will follow. For it will be very grievous. And the doubling of Pharaoh's dreams meant that the thing is fixed by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So we control fasting, and God controls famine. And we understand that as Christadelphians because we don't have a personal devil running around doing these things, but we understand that. And you know, right now it's just a fact. You know, right now there's plenty of famines going on around this planet, and it's also a fact that we have plenty enough food to feed all those people, and the methods and distribution means to get it to them. And by the corruption of man and wicked governments of this world and so forth, people die because they don't get enough to eat. It says in Psalm 33:18-19, "Behold, the eye of the Lord is upon them that fear him, and upon them that hope in his mercy, to deliver their soul from death, and to keep them alive in famine." So there's a promise there that God will keep his elect alive in famine. And personally, I don't know if that's an absolute or not, but I think it's... interesting that what it says is God's not going to spare his children from famine. The promise is not that he's going to spare any of us from famine, but that he's going to keep us alive. Isaiah 14:28-30 says, "In the year of Ahaz died came this proclamation, all of Philistia, do not rejoice because the rod which used to beat you is now broken. For the serpent stock will produce a viper. Its offspring will be a flying dragon. While the firstborn of the poor are grazing and the destitute are resting in safety, I will make your stock die of hunger and then slaughter what remains of you. Howl, gate, shriek, city, totter, all Philistia, for a smoke is coming from the north and there will be no deserters in those battalions. What reply will be given then to the messengers of that nation? That Yahweh founded Zion, and there the poor of his people will find refuge." So this again says, here's, now we're dealing with a heathen nation. But still, God is giving a message. And this was not just one a random act of chance. God was sending a message in this calamity that was going to come upon these people. That's a different reference. I've got the same reference on there, but I apologize. Awake, awake to your feet, Jerusalem, you who from Yahweh's hand have drunk the cup of His wrath, the chalice, the stupefying cup, you have drained to the dregs. There is no one to guide all the children she has borne, no one to grasp her hand of all the children she has reared. Double disaster has befallen you in there, and who is there to sympathize? Pillage and ruin, famine and sword, who is there to console you? Your children are lying helpless at the end of every street, like an antelope trapped in the net. They are filled to the brim with Yahweh's wrath, with the rebuke of your God. So again, while this may seem extraordinarily brutal, and I've never seen a famine personally up front, up close, and you know, I've seen it on TV and things like that, but I can't think of a more horrible situation to be in, that you cannot find food, and you have children that you cannot feed. And it, you see those commercials and stuff on TV, and it just breaks your heart. But again, that is a major calling from God to say, you know, consider your ways. Right. Yeah, well, that's why I said. Yeah, that's why I'm saying I'm not sure that that verse is an absolute in the sense that it never happens. That's why I made that comment that I think, you know, that it's not an absolute. That's where I would lean, that it's a principle that God does protect those. But, you know, look, we have children that die, probably there's people in here that have suffered the loss of a child, and you know, there's no guarantees except that Romans 8:28 that says all things work together for good that them that love God are called according to His purpose. That's the promise that we have. It's somehow God is working for good, and in a study of Job, you find that God was working for good. This horrible thing happened to this man. But in that, he was working for good. And it just becomes a matter of trust. And sometimes we don't see how on earth any good can come out of some of these things. But I think it just gets down to a pure... That's where you're down to pure, basic faith, I think. I don't know if that answers your question. That doesn't necessarily answer all my questions either. Psalm 37:18-19 says, "The lives of the just are in Yahweh's care. Their birthright will endure forever. They will not be put to shame. When bad times come, in times of famine, they will have plenty." And again, I'm not sure that is an absolute. But we're going to look at a wonderful example of what I think this is all about in a minute. Actually, right after this slide. "The days are coming, declares the Lord Yahweh, when I shall send famine on the country, not hunger for food, not thirst for water, but famine for hearing Yahweh's word. People will stagger from sea to sea, will wander from north to south, north to east, searching for Yahweh's word, but will not find it." Again, we've got a connection between fasting and hunger for the Word. And I'm not sure, I've always interpreted this verse correctly. I'm not sure that this verse is not saying that, I've always looked at this verse as that somehow God is going to withhold His Word. And I'm not sure anymore that that's what this means. I think it may mean that one day people are going to really, really want it, like they want food, that they're going to search for it high and low, that it's going to be their passion. And we don't see that in the world surrounding us today, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on that. Anybody have any thoughts on that right now?
So I have a sense that it's not that God is sort of withholding His Word, but that people are not sharing His Word, or that there aren't enough. Sort of, I mean, it's a little bit like the food situation. It's not that there's not enough food, it's that...
not enough workers in the harvest.
That's right, humanity inflicted on others. And that here, there's a situation where there's a scarcity of believers, and maybe the believers who are there aren't actually active. So people need the Word of God, but there's nobody around to tell us.
That's a good thought, John. Thank you for that. Did everybody hear what he said? The back? No? Yeah? Yep? Okay. Now, now we're going to look at one of the really powerful lessons about fasting. And this is from one of my favorite, I don't know if it's right to have favorite books of the Bible, but I have several favorite books. But anyway, Habakkuk is one of my favorite books. And so I'm going to give you what time is this class over? In 1 minute? Well, you're not going to get Habakkuk today. We're going to start with Habakkuk tomorrow. And tomorrow, Lord willing, we'll start with a 5-minute overview of Habakkuk and how this relates to our past, our topic. And I think this is, when we're talking about the nature of trials and we're talking about this, Habakkuk is a very, very important book. For theodicy. Theodicy is a fancy word that means if God is all good and all powerful, why does evil exist? And Habakkuk is a wonderful book for this, and it deals directly with this idea of famine. So we'll pick up there tomorrow, Lord willing.